Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska!
People ask me, you must have been the class clown. And I say, no, I wasn't.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, July 20, 2022, and this is the Bob Seska interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 549 of the Biden-Harris administration, 107 days until the 22 midterms. I'm on Instagram. My handle is TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and of course, our Patreon is BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, I've been looking forward to today's show for weeks and weeks now, ever since Kimberly and I first watched the Gaslit miniseries on Starz. It's the Watergate era story of Martha Mitchell, John Mitchell, G. Gordon Liddy, and John Dean. And joining us today is the creator and executive producer of Gaslit, the great Robbie Pickering. Not only did he create the series, but also wrote several of the episodes, including one of the greatest scenes in TV history, as far as I'm concerned. So today, we're going to talk with Robbie about producing the show and, of course, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about fascist weirdo G. Gordon Liddy. And in case you haven't seen Gaslit, you can find it on the Starz Network and the Starz streaming app, as well as on Hulu, Amazon Prime, and Apple TV. Meantime, if you like what you hear today, please help support this show by subscribing to our bonus content at patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. All right, here's me and Robbie Pickering talking about Gaslit.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
I noticed your Bud Cort avatar, which is the same as the avatar on Twitter, and my Tuesday co-host, Buzz Burbank, who was Liddy's news anchor at WJFK, by the way, is wondering about Bud Cort. Like, what is the significance of Bud Cort with you?
Oh, I just like, I screen grabbed, I think I was way back in the day when I first got on Facebook or something. I was looking for a profile picture and I love Harold and Maude. And I thought I screen grabbed the shot of Bud Cort pointing a pistol at himself, about to kill himself. And I thought it really summed my attitude up.
What a wonderful, wonderful movie, isn't it? Is that in your sort of pantheon of favorites?
Yeah. It's up there. All of Hal Ashby's movies are The Landlord, being there. You know, everything except, you know, The Slugger's Wife and 8 Million Ways to Die, I think, are every one of Hal Ashby's movies are up there for me. I'm not a huge fan of Coming Home, actually.
Oh, so. Really? Really? God, because that's like my favorite Hal Ashby movie. Coming.
I like it. You know, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Good John Voight performance. It's just too Vietnam-y for me.
It is a little dark and tragic. It's not an easy watch. That's for sure. It's certainly not Harold and Maude.
No, you know, exactly.
But, you know, now that you mentioned Hal Ashby, there is kind of a Hal Ashby tone. There's a little bit of that patina in Gaslit. Am I mistaking that, or is that kind of in there in the writing a bit?
Yeah, most of my influences are kind of either 70s comedy. I really love 70s comedies because you don't a lot of times you don't really know what, if they're a comedy or drama or what they are. And they're really rough around the edges. And sometimes you're not sure where they're going or what they're doing. That goes for a lot of the dramas too. You know, Michael Ritchie's movies like Downhill Racer is just kind of like a baffling movie for a little. And Charlie Varick Walter Matthau. Night Moves with Gene Hackman. I mean, all these different genres where you're like, and look, all of Robert Altman movies too, where you're just going to say, like, this thing is unwieldy and what is it exactly? I'm a big fan of that. And definitely Hal Ashby's movies. I mean, The Landlord was the first movie that he made, and it really is like straddling this line between satire and comedy and drama in a way that a lot of other movies don't. So I'm a big fan of that, but most of my influences are comedies. I mean, I would say chiefly like Enlightened with Laura Dern and The Larry Sanders Show, very much so.
Oh my God. Yeah. The Larry Sanders Show, especially now, I think deserves a little bit more of a look back to that series as something that broke all kinds of new ground. I mean, you can see the now ancestors of the Larry Sanders Show.
Everything, yeah.
In all kinds of ways, from The Office
The Office is very much Larry Sanders influenced, especially The Office. And if you look at Larry Sanders, if you want to know how to write fascists in a very realistic way, all you have to do is look at Hey Now, Hank Kingsley, and like write him as G. Gordon Liddy. You know, You know, there's a lot of Hank Kingsley and G. Gordon Liddy. There's a lot of Artie and John Mitchell. There's a lot of Larry Sanders and I think Martha Mitchell. I think that, and that's just saying that I wasn't specifically thinking of, well, I'm going to put some Hank in here. It's just that Larry Sanders, the character types are very identifiable. It's the first time on TV you saw, film was doing it too, but before this, but it's kind of the first time on TV you saw this. You know, there's this thing when you watch Ricky Gervais on The Office that you watch him and you think he's such an idiot. Yeah. But at the back of your mind, you're thinking, I did something like that once.
I totally know. Exactly what you're talking about. Oh, my God. When that series first came out, I was working on an animated sketch comedy show that I sold to VH1. And I went out to L.A. to deal with the writer's room and everything like that and participate in the early writing process. And I felt like Ricky Gervais walking around and meeting the writers. There were times where I just, and this is my own self-consciousness coming into it, and my own insecurity, I would go around thinking, oh shit, are they thinking of me like I'm David Brent or something like that? Am I layering it on too thick?
They absolutely are. They absolutely are. 100%. And that's the thing. Like we really, you know, when I first hired writers for Gaslit, my first question in the interview was always, you know, it was to each of them was, name a character of yourself. And you see in one of the characters, and the only qualification is it can't be a good quality of yourself. It has to be a shameful, embarrassing quality of yourself you see in the characters. And that's how you write fascists. Mm-hmm. That's how you write Republicans. That's how you write. You have to see yourself in them some way. And, you know, Liddy, you know, I really, I'm a Watergate geek and a Nixon geek, and you know, when you read about Operation Gemstone and the pitch Liddy gave, if your listeners don't know, Liddy gave this huge pitch of espionage activities that he was supposed, you know, they hired him to kind of, and they didn't know they hired a crazy guy, and they hired him to kind of come up with these espionage targets for the Democrats, and came up with horrible, like huge, stupid, like bugging yachts and putting video in yachts and inviting Democratic senators there with whores and turning off the air conditioner at the Democratic National Convention, sabotaging the air conditioner so they'd be sweating on national television, and all these cockamamie things that were just crazy. And he labeled them all. He called them all Operation Gemstone, and just reading, knowing about that, and knowing about him pitching this to, you know, John Mitchell and John Dean and all these people who had hired him, and just, they don't get it. I immediately empathized with them because I thought, this is just giving a TV or a movie pitch to people who just completely don't get what you're doing and think you're an idiot, and not realizing it until afterwards.
Exactly.
And the pain and the sadness you feel, that's exactly what Liddy, because Liddy did cry after that pitch. He was very embarrassed.
Yeah.
And I really feel for that. But that the kind of human stakes of that, you know, juxtaposed with, this is at the highest level of federal government. I mean, if Liddy was running a Chick-fil-A in Omaha, the place would go over under in a month and nobody would have heard of him.
Yeah.
But he's a guy they hired to, at this level of federal government. It ultimately, the chain reaction was it destroyed faith in U.S. government, which is a very tragic thing. And I think fascism is like tyranny of the mediocre that starts out funny but ends with very tragic things. I mean, when you read about Adolf Eichmann, he was just an idiot.
Well, that, you know, that was the thing. I mean, you could go back to Hank Kingsley on this too, because Hank Kingsley, well, much like Liddy, had this unsubstantiated self-confidence plus this layer of delusion that drove him
forward. And like gross insecurity.
Yeah, like, exactly. But then there was also, with Hank, there was a layer of empathy. And one of the things that you were able to incorporate into Gaslit is, while, you know, we're looking at Liddy as this maniac, there was also a layer of empathy in there, which I think is important. And just as a kind of a statement in terms of the kind of empathy that was built into the character, my liberal feminist girlfriend is now utterly, like, fascinated with Gordon Liddy. I mean, specifically Shay's Liddy. I mean, so much that she's actually demanding that you make a sequel called Liddy, starring Shay Whigham reprising his role. She's kind of in love with Gordon Liddy, knowing that he's this fascist, Nazi adjacent maniac. But at the same time, I think it was because of the way you kind of empathize with him on a certain level, especially in that episode where he's in solitary chasing after that rat. I mean, was that kind of part of the development of the character, to kind of incorporate empathy into Liddy as a person?
Well, yeah. I mean, with all of the characters, it's not even with all the characters I do, I don't want to write just pure crazy people.
Villains,
or pure, or pure stupid people. Like, I think that the best characters in any show or movie, I mean, take Amy Jellicoe and Enlightened, Laura Dern's character. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but you never know quite whether she's the villain or the hero, or she's crazy or she's sane or whatever. And it's, I think that's the first female character, one of the first that's allowed that kind of latitude with her and complexity in her character in TV. But you're always, you always understand why she's doing what she's doing on some level. It's not even a question that you have to empathize with. I have to empathize with all the characters because I don't think I can write them if I do. So
yeah.
I think with Liddy, look, when I was a kid, my grandma was a Nazi in Germany. She was like one of those secretaries that was picked to be secretary for Hitler. Yeah, and then she married my white trash grandpa from Kansas when he was over there in Germany after the war. She came over here, and all my Texas, you know, I grew up in a small town in Texas, very evangelical right wing, and they would always be like, you know, your grandma, and she died when I was two. And they would always say, well, you know, your grandma, she was a Nazi. But the thing was, she was just so sweet and she didn't have a mean bone in her body. She came over here. She was so sweet. She was a Nazi. And the thing you don't know is that Nazis, not all of them were bad, you know, but some of them just didn't know. And some of them just this and that. Most of them, you know, you got to know it was all of Germany and they weren't all bad. And when I was a kid, I was like, they were trying to tell me it as if to reassure me that it wasn't, my grandma wasn't an evil person. And I thought, yeah, the fact that she isn't an evil person is what's evil about it. The fact that all of these people weren't just, you know, monsters, that they could all, that's the scary thing about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you look at somebody like Liddy, or when you look at somebody like John Mitchell, or you look at these villains, I think John Dean is a villain. I think that, I mean, me personally, my political beliefs, I think that, you know, I mean, look at somebody like Jeff Clark or Pat Cipollone or Paul Manafort.
Yeah.
These people all are very, you know, I'm sure most of them are very loved by the people in their life. Mm-hmm. And they're very, I mean, I know John Mitchell, who is a huge monster. You know, after Martha Mitchell died, Martha's son, who was John's stepson, kept calling John Mitchell dad afterwards.
Wow.
Even though his dad had done all these horrible things to his mom, because he thought he was such a great guy. And Liddy was great too. He had this beautiful love with his wife, but you have to keep in mind that this guy is a zealot and he believes in what he's doing and he's funny and he's charismatic. But if America were to go Nazi, that guy would be at the gates of the concentration camp greeting everybody.
Absolutely true. Yep,
100%. And so the harder thing to do was not over empathize with Liddy. The harder thing to do was, because you really, Liddy is really likable in that Trump way. He's really fun. He's really entertaining. I mean, Liddy's book, Will, is the most honest, entertaining, insane book. Out of anybody in Watergate to get a beer with, I would love to get a beer with G. Gordon Liddy and sit there. And look, you guys worked with him. I was subjected to that man's radio show.
Yeah, you were saying.
Every day when my stepdad would take me to school, every morning I had to listen to G. Gordon Liddy ranting. So I didn't like that, but he is entertaining. And the thing you have to keep in mind is how dangerous he is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And not get sucked in by his charisma and how funny he is. And in something like what we were doing, it's like, don't get sucked in. It's so easy to make this guy funny and entertaining, but you got to have that turn where you see, oh, he's also dangerous.
I found myself watching the series and experiencing the same thing I experienced when I worked across the, you know, plate glass window from him at WJFK. And it was this constant balancing match between, holy shit, fuck this guy with this guy and all of his ridiculousness, but also, I can't stop listening. I can't. And it wasn't just because he would occasionally catch me laughing at one of his jokes through the glass and say, oh, look at those high pockets. Thought that joke was funny, John Pop. And it wasn't just that he was mentioning me on his show. As you said, he was genuinely charismatic and a fascinating, fascinating character in American history, while all at the same time being deadly dangerous. I mean, that was the ongoing thing. And that's what you captured with Gaslit. And Shay obviously brought a lot to it as well. But that's what was one of the many great things about the portrayal of Liddy in this miniseries.
I think that if Shay had ever, I mean, the reason I picked Shay and the reason I first thought of him, because it was going to be Joel Edgerton at a certain point was going to play Liddy.
Joel
had to leave. And I just wanted to pick somebody who wouldn't be making fun of Liddy, who would be inside Liddy. Because the way we wrote him, it could have been a wink, wink thing to the audience.
It could have been cartoonish. It could have been a cartoon.
If you ever got the sense that the actor was playing him, and And if you ever got the sense that the actor wasn't totally in the head of this guy and was winking at the audience at any moment, the whole thing would have fallen apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we knew, I you know, I'm a big fan of Shea Whigham, and I knew that I just never see him wink at the audience like that. It was never a thing. You know, if you're getting Will Ferrell to play Gordon Liddy or Danny McBride or something, they're going to be, I love those guys, but they're going to be winking at the audience the whole time. And then it just falls apart because the genius of Watergate on a comedic level and on a dramatic level is it's just the story of a bunch of corporate middle manager office types who are pretty shady, who hired a crazy man and didn't know how to deal with it. You know, you've been at those corporate jobs where somebody's just nuts and nobody wants to fire him.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And they're just kind of all like ignoring it. And, you know, they're non-confrontational. That's really how Watergate started.
And with someone like Gordon Liddy, I think they'd be afraid to fire him. I mean, that would be a challenging ask because you never know.
Also, they're doing illegal stuff.
Yeah,
you can't. Look, the thing is, when you get shady people at the top of government, you're not hiring the best people. If you want to do shady shit at the top of government, you're not hiring the best people. If you want to do criminal stuff and hire the best people, the mafia's for you.
Oh, yeah. Right.
That's where the best people are. Mm. They're not at the top of government. They're not in another movie I really like is Steven Soderbergh's movie, The Informant, with Matt Damon, because it's just showing how kind of dumb this guy is and kind of how mundanely stupid corruption on a corporate level is. It's just it's not geniuses, I don't think. I think it's pretty, you know, maybe one genius and a bunch of dumb people.
This is kind of out of left field, Robbie, but I've been curious, how does it work with the estates of some of these characters? Liddy, I think, died in, what was it, 2018? Or maybe it was 2020. I forget. It was recently in which he died. And a lot of these other characters are long since passed away. What are the legal ramifications of dramatizing their lives in a miniseries like that? Do you have to get clearances or something like that?
No, not if they're passed away. I mean, we were very... I don't have any feelings about G. Gordon Liddy dying. I think personally, I feel sorry for his family and all that. But I mean, I think he was a pretty rotten person.
Yeah.
But we were on a professional level, we were definitely pretty pumped that he died because he, you know, if somebody's still alive, the basic thing is like, if they're deceased, they can't, there's no defamation case if someone's deceased. So, I mean, you know, the John Dean was a concern, but just because John Dean, Liddy has spread all these cockamamie theories about John Dean's wife being a prostitute, and that's why they were committing the Watergate break-in. There's a whole, that's what John Dean sues for, and we weren't doing that.
Liddy really turned John into his nemesis. Even during his radio show years, he couldn't shut up about how John Dean was a rat, and every chance he got, he was talking about how John Dean ratted on him and the entire Watergate conspiracy.
I kind of empathize with that to a certain degree because my beef with John Dean is that the guy has been on the Watergate welfare train for 50 years. And, you know, somebody like Martha Mitchell, who told the truth way before he did and wasn't at the center of the whole, you know, criminal plot. She's not remembered at all. And anytime people like John Dean mention Martha Mitchell, it's still to say how crazy she was and how they felt sorry for John Mitchell and stuff like that. And it's just like, you know, all these guys were alcoholics. All of them were pill poppers. All of them were sex addicts. All these guys were awful and complex and all that. And I don't hold that against them, but it's just like John Dean, you know, he can't get enough of the spotlight of this thing. And I sometimes feel like, look, the same opportunism that caused you to be at the center of this thing caused you to speak out. And, you know, one of the points of the show is that heroism doesn't always come from the most selfless place, comes from selfish places sometimes.
Yeah.
So it was heroic for him to speak out, but I just think he should shut the fuck up at some point.
It was a
let somebody else.
There was a superficial aspect to his, and this is how it was certainly portrayed in the series, where, you know, he's picking out just the right glasses to make himself look more, I don't know, studious when he's testifying. Yeah, there was kind of a performance that they set up
it
with John Dean's
testimony. Everything was a performance. The whole thing about how he has a photographic memory and could remember these conversations verbatim, it's bullshit. The whole thing is a performance, and he's still performing on cable news. I mean, you know, he says every presidential scandal is worse than Watergate. I mean, the guy, I don't know. I just get a little sick of the, you know, there was a bunch of people always ask me, did I talk to John Dean, and did I get his story, his side of the story from him and all that? And I'm like, no, that guy's side of the story is out there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 50 like, years of history.
He's very sanitized. I didn't do anything except cover it up. Side of the story is out there. And, you know, I don't think we made him look terrible in the series.
No.
I just think we made him look what he was, which is an opportunist. And, you know, his first book about it is called Blind Ambition. I mean, he admitted to it. This whole thing bugs me.
On the other side of the coin, too, it's funny because Liddy famously didn't rat on the co-conspirators of Watergate, but years later, he would never shut the fuck up about Watergate. I mean, even the license plate on his car said H2O Gate.
H2O Gate.
Became all about it. Yeah.
I think that Liddy, here's what I would say about Liddy. You know, this is my personal take on him. All of this, the whole show, you know, one of the things that people misunderstand about the show is that it's not the facts. It's my truth of what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the truth. I mean, we stick to the facts mostly, but I'm more concerned about the truth of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I can't reach any objective truth about how it happened. All I can say is, Here's what I think the truth of this is, and hope people respond to it. And my truth about G. Gordon Liddy and what I think and what I put in the show is that G. Gordon Liddy went from kind of a soldier to a prophet, from a soldier to a storyteller, to an actor.
Yeah.
He went from G. Gordon Liddy ready to do the dirt, you know, do the espionage dirt for the Republican Party, to an Alex Jones.
Yeah.
And to being a proto, you know, Rush Limbaugh, Alex, a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I think at some point the Republican Party figured out, we can just tell stories.
Yeah.
We can just tell the stories. We don't have to do all this stuff. We can just tell the story and we can just act and spread it.
Yeah.
And we'll create an army of Liddies.
You know, it's kind of an amazing story with Liddy. I mean, within 10 years, he went from threatening to rip Jeb Magruder's arm out of the socket and beat him to death with it to co-starring as the villain on Miami Vice. That was his trajectory over a very short span of time.
He went from hating Timothy Leary to going on tour with him. I mean, the thing is, he became a performance artist. And
that's a great way to put it.
And that and so when he's saying all this stuff about John Dean and how he's a rat, he's performing.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think he liked John Dean.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why he didn't like John Dean. But the reason I don't like John Dean is not because he's a rat and he's this and that. Is that I think John Dean is kind of a like, you know, I don't think he's the most likable. He had the most likable motivations for what he was doing. And I don't think he's generally afterwards acted in a way that's very, you know, honorable on a certain level.
Yeah.
It's not anything huge, but I think that's where Liddy's you know, I think that's probably the extent of Liddy's dislike for him, and the rest is performance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. And along those lines, among other episodes, you wrote the finale with Liddy confronting John Dean with the, you know, you can kill a guy. You used to say it on a show all the time. You can kill a guy with a pencil. And it's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen, certainly on television, much less films and so on. How did you approach that? I mean, that had to have been a daunting monologue to jump into, or did it kind of roll right off your head? I mean, what was the process in constructing that Liddy monologue with the pencil and eating the rat's pups and all of that? I mean, just the use of the word pups showed to me that you had this laser-focused insight into Liddy's personality and the kind of terminology that he would use. Because in real life, he would absolutely refer to the rat's babies as the rat's pups. And I
have, yeah.
Liddy just would little be, details
Liddy
like
would
that.
Be very, very specific about it.
Yeah.
I was upset that a lot of stuff I put in for Liddy to say, Shay just thought it was too much. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, look, you know, Liddy actually said this word. I mean, one of them was, I can't remember the word. It's from an interview in, I forget what it.
Yeah.
I forget what the word, it's like stuff that I can't come up with. Like
right.
He speaks beautifully, you know, mm-hmm. and in a weird way. I mean, he speaks in that way Mike Tyson speaks, where he's like, that nobody would ever take my skullduggery and my, you know, and it's like, he's using all these flowery words. I mean, Mike Tyson yes. uses malapropisms, but, mm-hmm. but Liddy is just using these, like, he's just so verbose and yeah. it, you know, and in anybody else's mouth, it would sound verbose and bad, but
it, right. It's like he was raised in the 1870s or something like that, where yeah, it was Victorian and yeah. very flowery yeah. language.
So with Liddy, I think that with that scene in particular, I mean, look, the way I came up with it was honestly, I needed something for Liddy to do in prison. I knew we were coming up on that. That I knew he was going to be in prison. I didn't have anything for him to do in prison. Mm-hmm. I thought something with the rat. And then I told the writer's room, you guys, you know, keep, you know, the way we do it is we, you know, me and my friend Amelia wrote the second, third episode. And then the rest of the episodes, I already had the outlines for them, and we kind of beat them out in more specific detail with the room. And then when we got to a problem, honestly, I would go into the next office, and I'm not a big weed smoker, but I just get high and write in a notebook and try to come up with a solution.
Perfect.
And we had Liddy in the prison. And I thought, I see a rat or something. And yeah, I just went in there for a day or so and just got high and thought what could happen. And I came up with a montage where he goes to prison and he's writing to his wife and he's describing how great it is. And you're seeing this contradiction on juxtaposition of the screen, you know, like yeah. everybody's so nice in prison. They're so courteous. And then it's a CO asking everybody to turn around and pick up their nut sack and bend over, you know, like just showing that this is Liddy's, like this prison is this for this insane guy. He is in his element here. And I came up with, you know, everything's going well for him and he gets thrown in the cell with this and starts hearing this rat. And it, you know, it's kind of like, that's interesting. That's like a telltale heart kind of thing. And
yeah.
he's trying to find this rat and I don't want to give it away to your audience, but I came up with the whole run through that, you know, through the end of that episode where, you know, the thing with the rat happens. And then I came up with, the speech in the room because the yeah. with Dean in the eighth episode, because that actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a room with Dean. He got put in there accidentally with him. And the whole time Dean thought he was going to kill him with a pencil because
yeah.
Liddy was famous for going around. And I had the idea of kind of stopping the rat story short, and then you find out what happened in that room. And I came, you know, I got sober and I went back in the writer's room and I said, okay, just everybody shut up for while I describe this run to you. And I knew it was good because by the time Liddy, there's a revelation at the end of that scene with Dean about what happened with him and the rat.
Yeah.
And I knew I had everybody because the writer's room was mostly women, but everybody was like, when I said, you know, and Dean says to him, what'd you do with the rat? And Liddy says blank. They all gasped. Like they all, you know, one of the women was like, Oh no. And I knew I had it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I had the next beat too, the one at the end of the montage. And
which is important. I thought that was an important little beat to throw in there at the end. It kind of lets you off the hook a little bit with the original story.
Well, it's Liddy's a storyteller at the end, right? Mm-hmm. He's you know, Alex Jones, he fakes it.
Yep.
You know, he's telling stories. I mean, I don't know that Alex Jones fakes it now, but I think at some point he was. And then it was just about writing that scene. And I don't know, just I think that scene just it kind of just came to me. I just describing, I don't know, I think I kind of channeled him in a weird way. Somebody said to me in an interview, why would you describe the rat? Because at one point he says, I was haunted by a bitch rat with buck teeth and suckled teeth that dotted her underbelly. Mm-hmm. And the interviewer was like, why would you write it like that? And I thought about it, and I never thought about it before. And I thought, well, I think I was just in his head and, you know, kind of looking at the grossest sides of myself. And it's like, I think Liddy would probably has this disgust for a woman's body in a weird way and a fascination with it. But it's also the worst and a bitch rat who had been pregnant and had suckled teats would be such a thing that would stick out in his mind.
Very specific. Yeah.
Yeah. He's so afraid of women and also enthralled to them. And I think it was just kind of channeling it. And I don't know. It was one of those things where, you know, God spoke to me. I don't know how I did it. It was,
I got to tell you, it's a work of genius. I mean, the whole series is wonderful, but that sequence right there in that conference room at the courthouse is absolutely fucking brilliant. I mean, what a piece of work.
They both play it well. And one of my favorite lines, actually, my favorite line is, I've watched you die so many times in my delicious fantasies. Mm-hmm. He says, hung by the neck from a rafter, impaled ass first on an iron spit. Decapitated by a lawnmower blade. And every time he gets to decapitated by a lawnmower blade, I'm like, where the hell did that come from? Decapitated by a lawnmower blade?
Again,
and I'm watching it thinking like, oh, somebody else wrote this. That's so weird.
Yeah, that's just it. Weird is the perfect word. Also, like, awkward specificity. It's like one beat off the mainstream as far as something someone would describe, right?
Well, I think I just always had this really huge fear when I was a kid of being cut open by a lawnmower blade because I used to have to mow everybody's lawn and my mom would ride this big wide lawnmower and I just had these nightmares about getting trapped and then lawnmower blade just, you know, cutting my head in half or something. And I think it must have been just like a lawnmower blade is like a machete to me. I don't know. Yeah, but it's like that weird specificity. The way you write a character like that is you have to take your weird specificity and put it in his mouth and like somehow get yourself to commune with the spirit of that person, and which is the same way Shay has to play it.
All right, if you're pissed off at cable news and other very serious political analysts these days, here's an outstanding way to support independent media, specifically this podcast. For just $5 per month, you can support our Patreon page as we guide you through the madness and chaos of our politics. But it's not just about supporting shows like this one. You're also going to get bonus content as a reward for your monthly support. We're talking about exclusive access to our Shadow Docket show recorded after the end credits on our Tuesday and Thursday shows. You also get access to the Patreon app where you can download the free show and our bonus content. Plus, you can join the discussion with our community of Patreon members in the comments under each episode. All that for just $5 per month, just pennies per show. Don't miss out. Again, that's bobseskashow.com. Bookmark it, send it to all your friends, and we thank you.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way. Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Bob Seska! All-time favorites all day long!
And talking about Liddy as much as we are, we're almost kind of overlooking how interesting and multi-layered the relationship was between John and Martha Mitchell. It was a very complicated and fascinating relationship to look on. Obviously, this huge layer of abuse and tragedy. But at what point did you get two like legit A-list movie stars into the project, Julia Roberts and Sean Penn? How did they end up getting involved? How'd you get them?
Well, Julia, you know, when I first wrote the script, the other producers were like, hey, who's on the top of your list? And I said, well, you know, Julia Roberts, but we'll go to somebody else. Let's talk about that. They were like, no, let's send it to Julia. And I just thought, whatever, you know, let's send it to Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
Let's also send it to the Pope, you know? And,
exactly.
And she, within a week and a half, she was like, I want to do it. And she really wanted to do it with Sean. And I was really nervous about Sean.
Because he's intimidating or?
Well, I think Sean is, you know, intimidating as a person. He didn't look like John Mitchell really. I didn't want it to turn into like a political Jeremiad, you know? So I went to eat dinner with Sean in Malibu.
Wow.
And I wore this stupid leather jacket. It's so dumb. I just wanted to look cool. And I got there and I was with Sean and I took it off and hung it over the chair before I said it was so dumb.
It's like David Brent. It's a David Brent moment, Robbie.
Yeah, a very David Brent, very Sergio Giorgini, you know, like you remember that? Yeah. What, you know, where he says to his boss, what brand is your jacket? He says Armani, and the boss goes, what brand is yours? He goes, Sergio Giorgini.
Yes, I love it. Very oh my David God. Brent. That's a deep cut from The Office. Yeah.
Very David Brent, but I sat down and we talked, and he just from the jump was laser focused on marriage and little things in marriage that drive you nuts. And this marriage between these two people, and you know, he had this story about his dad used to smoke a pipe like John Mitchell did. I'm probably bastardizing the story, but his dad like didn't know which pipe stem fit with which one without his mom there. And you know, when his mom would go, it'd just be this little signifier of how lost his dad was without his mom. And we put that in there. We put that into the show. Yeah. I immediately heard that. And I just couldn't have been more into him doing it after that. Because it was never about, I mean, Sean Penn's a genius. It was never about, you know, the talent. Or it's just like, you know, he's such a 800-pound gorilla that you got to meet with. And so after that, you know, everything came together. You know, who doesn't want to act in a show with Julia Roberts and Sean Penn? And, yeah, yeah. And we put it all together. You know, we got great. I mean, Armie Hammer had to drop out for, he was, he got the offer, that show, The Offer. And then this whole cannibalism thing happened and he had to leave that show. But that was fortunate because we got Dan Stevens. Dan Stevens is amazing. Mm-hmm. And then Joel Edgerton had to drop out, but I immediately was like, go to Shea Whigham. And within, you know, 2 days, Shea was like, I'm going to do it. And it just all came together. And yeah, it was very fortunate. I wish there was something more complicated than that. But yeah. Once Julia came on, I mean, it was very legit.
Well, you had to have been nervous, though, about casting Sean and realizing that he would have to use prosthetic makeup appliances in order to make him look like
John Mitchell. I didn't want him to use prosthetics. I said to Sean, look, nobody, the great thing about not doing a show about the 90s, about doing it about the 70s and mm-hmm. Watergate is, you know, nobody remembers these people. And, you know, we don't have to make you look like John Mitchell. And he looks at me and he goes, Robbie, I remember John Mitchell.
That's and a perfect impression, like, too. Yeah.
And I was like, all right, Sean Penn, you know, I'm not going to argue with that. And I thought it was going to be like a disaster, but then he had the guy he wanted. He had Kazuhiro, who did Darkest Hour and Bombshell and all these movies that were really, the makeup was so artful and amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first time I saw him, I was just like, in the makeup, I just thought, oh my God, yes.
It's incredible. Because it's the best I've ever seen, Robbie. I've never seen makeup on a face that was that realistic, that was that well done. It's like a giant step ahead for makeup effects, at least from
based on what I've seen. The thing I get confused about, though, is a lot of people, you know, I've seen online and stuff, people are like, I didn't know it was Sean Penn until episode 7 and stuff like that. I look at the thing I loved about the makeup was that I still saw in the center of the face Sean Penn.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I still saw Sean Penn and I still knew, I still could see his
smile. It was a smile.
Him. I could see him. I like watched that the Batman movie and Colin Farrell as the Penguin in there.
Mm-hmm. It's also good.
It's good. It's very good makeup, but I can't tell in any way that's Colin Farrell. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe it's because I saw Sean Penn every day, but I can really tell that's Sean Penn. To the point now when I see Sean in real life or on TV or something, I'm like, oh, that's Sean Penn in a skinny suit. You know,
like. Yeah, right. Well, I mean, one of the things that makes it so good, it's obviously the prosthetics and the artistry that went into creating them. That's the main thing. But sometimes you get an actor, be an A-list actor with that kind of makeup on, and they can't quite work in it. They can't quite push through it. I think their faces feel confined and they're afraid to open their mouths or to smile too broadly for fear that it's going to pull away. And Sean did a wonderful job performing through the makeup.
I was amazed. Yeah. I got to tell you, I was really nervous about the suit and the makeup and all that. I was amazed. And to me, you know, in a show with like uniformly brilliant performance. I mean, Betty Gilpin is, you know, so amazing in it. Dan Stevens is the best he's ever been in it. Mm-hmm. Shea Whigham to me is the best he's ever been in this. Julia is the best she's ever been.
Yeah.
Sean really he really holds the show together. And he's, you know, we had a rule in the writer's room to write funny lines for Sean Penn. to write vulnerable scenes for Sean Penn, because I think Sean is best when he's funny and vulnerable and all that. Look at Milk, look at Carlito's Way, look at Sweet and Lowdown. He's best when he's kind of funny and vulnerable. Oh, yeah. Or it's maybe the most undervalued part of his toolbox, you know? And I think the makeup helps in a way. Yeah. It makes him softer and more, I don't know, lovable in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Carlito's Way, because as I was watching his performance in Gaslit, that's one of the other characters he's played that I kept going back to. And it's not necessarily like they're the same character, but they're whatever you planned as far as his performance and the writing for John Mitchell, you did get a little bit of that callback to, you know, a character like he played in Carlito's Way. There was something about it. There was some, there
well,
was,
it's
a, there was
like
a tonal
a, it's
thing.
Like a, it's like a, it's like a white collar criminal in over his head, you know? Right, I mean, right. Carlito's Way is so brilliant. I mean, talk about, you're in this movie with Al Pacino and Viggo Mortensen and Luis Guzman and all these brilliant people. And, you know, Sean Penn just steals the show in that movie. Yeah. And Penelope Ann Miller and all these great people. And of John Leguizamo, Benny Blanco from the Bronx.
Oh, yeah.
But Sean, really, you really believe that this guy in that movie is just so, it's just the wheels are falling off.
Yeah.
You know, like the center cannot hold. And in Gaslit is a slower version of that. But, you know, kind of the point at the end of the show is that this guy has spun out of control and his life is done.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's the one who is sentenced to loneliness for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. And because of what he's done. And, you know, there's a scene where he's watching, I'm sure you guys know, when he's watching Nixon on the TV, and he's kind of enthralled by Nixon. And, you know, it's this kind of vulnerability and loneliness that's and this kind of feeling of being in over your head. That's the same, I would say, is very similar to Carlito's Way. And, you know, in Sweet and Lowdown, he's got a lot of that kind of thing too. Falcon and the Snowman.
Yeah.
Same, you know, At Close Range, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a feeling. He portrayed a feeling of rejection too, because, and then he's got to disguise it in front of Martha because he's lying to Martha about being fired by the White House for his involvement in Watergate. So there was that layer on top of all the rest.
Oh,
of
the
it.
Embarrassment.
Yeah,
of
the
being
embarrassment.
Rejected and scapegoated by. Yeah, I really relate to that. And you know, Sean was very aware of all those things when he was playing these characters. Mm-hmm, I mean. Sure. When him and Martha have their huge fight, you know, in the seventh episode, I told Sean, you know, like, you know, when he's yelling at Martha and stuff and kind of when he's gaslighting her, I told him, look, this is a lot of this is based on my dad's divorce with my mom, you know? And,
wow.
And he said, you know what? I've been on the other side of this. I've been Martha, you know, I've had somebody doing this to me. And then at some point, oh my God, my favorite Sean Penn story is at the beginning of production. I don't know whether I should be telling this, but at the beginning of production, I talk about Martha and John a lot as this amour fou kind of relationship, you know, this kind of tumultuous, you love them and you hate them. Typically, that's what's really interesting about their stories. It's, typically, you have those relationships in your 20s, but these two people have it had it in their, you know, 40s and 50s. And, you know, this relationship where you hate them and you love them one day, hate them the next. And, oh, my God, you're going to remember this for the rest of your life, this tumult. And you can't stand them, but you can't get, you're infatuated and all that. And he says, well, I've never had a relationship like that. And then I'm kind of like nodding my head, and he turns to me slowly and he goes, well, maybe one. And I was like,
I know exactly the
homie
one.
Homie is talking about Madonna.
Madonna, obviously. Yeah, holy shit.
Oh my God.
Amazing.
You mentioned earlier about how you had people coming up to you and say, well, I didn't even realize that was Sean Penn until episode 6 or whatever it was. I imagine you had a lot of people coming up to you and saying, I had no idea they did that to Martha Mitchell. And yeah. I think that is the, I mean, we're obviously burying the lead here, but that's the headline of Gaslit, which is that unbelievable way Martha Mitchell was treated and ultimately for telling the truth. I mean, one of the greatest moments of Gaslit is that last shot over the end credits. Martha was right. And it was actually a thing at Martha Mitchell's funeral. Someone sent flowers that were in the shape of the words, Martha was right. And you nailed that history, that actual history. But it also made a wonderful statement about Martha Mitchell being right and underscoring the tragedy of Martha Mitchell. I mean, that could have been the title of the series, The Tragedy of Martha Mitchell, because it really is. I mean, she was fucking right the whole way through, and they treated her like she was insane. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Frank Wills, the black security guard who caught the Watergate burglars. I mean, there's kind of this monologue at the beginning of the show by Liddy where he talks about how history is not written by the women, the queers and the losers or something like that. It's written by soldiers carrying the banner of kings. And it's this whole like great man version of history, which I would categorize a lot of the movies, TV shows about Watergate that I like are the Oliver Stone kind of great man version.
Yeah.
Or great person version, because often it's the same thing with women, great women of history. You know, I think this First Lady show was kind of that version of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, who gives a shit about Eleanor Roosevelt or FDR? Like, I want to know about the people around them. I want to know about the little people, you know. I want to know about the losers. I don't want to know about the great people of history. Or I want it to be balanced out a little. And that monologue at the beginning of the show is kind of this antithesis of the show. And Liddy, by saying that monologue, is kind of telling you, it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek monologue because he's telling you what the show isn't about. Mm-hmm. You are about to see a show about the losers of history and the people that aren't remembered and the people who didn't change things but didn't get their due. And Frank Wills is one of those people, and Martha is one of those people. And it's a really, history is really random and cruel, you know. There's a line at the one, I think one of the other thesis statements in the show to me is at the end, John Dean has gotten out of everything. You know, I won't ruin what happens to him, but he kind of has this monologue about, you know, why me? Why do I get away with the book deal and the great marriage and the blah, blah, blah. You know, I did so many horrible things. I was participating in horrible things. We ruined something about this country. Why do I get away with all this great stuff? And Mo, his Betty Gilpin, kind of turns to him, looks him in the eyes and says, because John, you're good looking, and lays back down. And that's a thesis statement of the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, yeah, don't overthink history. John Dean got away because he's good looking. and he wasn't a woman who drank. He was a man who had problems. He was a good looking man who had problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
He wasn't a black man. If Frank Wills was a white guy security guard, there would be streets named Frank Wills Avenue.
Abso-fucking-lutely, yeah.
You know, if Martha was a man, or if Martha was one of these women who had it all together and didn't have any outward flaws, if she was a real Sheryl Sandberg type, she would be remembered too. Mm-hmm. But she was flawed. And she was doing something heroic for selfish reasons. And she was complicit in horrible things before she told the truth. And she drank a lot, blah, blah, blah. But who cares?
Right.
She told the truth. And she should be remembered. She was a hero and she paid for it. And the problem is not that John Dean is known too much. It's that he's known at the expense of other people being known. Mm-hmm. Like, The problem is not that he's known too much. It's that Martha should be known just as much as he is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what you've done successfully, among many other things, with Gaslit is to really emboss her name into history and modern history, which is extremely important. I mean, it's one thing to acknowledge Martha Mitchell in whatever, 1981. It's another thing entirely when here we are in 2022, remembering Martha Mitchell and knowing what she was able to accomplish, how she was treated, her place in this entire saga of Watergate, when in fact, you know, a lot of people, I think, still remember Liddy and Magruder and McCord and Ehrlichman. Yeah. And, you know, it's just like the names rattle off the head from, you know, seeing All the President's Men and so on. But Martha Mitchell, you have given her her spot. You've given her chapter in the history books. At least that's my hope, that now, because of this, Martha Mitchell is going to get the recognition that she deserves. And that's
I mean, I hope I have a 5-year-old daughter, and I hope when she's taught about Watergate, and if she doesn't fall asleep in the lecture about Watergate, I hope she's thought about Martha Mitchell now. And you know, one of the things that kept us going on the production was, you know, I recommend that everybody listen to the Slowburn podcast, which is what the show is inspired by. And you know, the creator of that podcast, Leon Nafok, he spoke to Martha's son, Jay, who is, both of her children are very private, and they don't really speak to anybody, understandably so. But he got the opportunity to speak to Jay once, and Jay, Martha's son, said, "All I want is for my mom to be remembered as something other than a drunk clown."
Yeah.
And that really kept me and all the writers and all the people who made the show, because it was very difficult to make. It was very difficult to get made. That's what kept us all going. I mean, I've been working on this for 4 years, and and that's all I think about is, you know, if we can do this one thing, that would be worth it all, you know?
Yeah.
Also, I love writing G. Gordon Liddy.
You know, I have incorporated Liddy and characters based on Liddy into things that I've done. I mean, I used to do animated cartoons on the internet back when that was really popular. And I made a cartoon character whose last name was Liddy, and he looked just like G. Gordon Liddy. It's a character who's fun to write for. But yeah, I mean, being inspired by Martha Mitchell's story, I think, as you said, was probably a lot of fuel to get you through a very difficult pitch selling process. Having dealt with Hollywood on occasion, it's not an easy town to get something as interesting and as creative and as insightful as Gaslit into the general public. I mean, it's an extraordinarily smart miniseries on top of being funny and interesting and historic. You know, it's one of those things where it's so clever and so, you know, kind of off the beaten path as far as its tone, that you had to have been running into roadblocks left and right. I can't even imagine the process getting this thing made.
Oh, it was a nightmare. Yeah. I mean, it was as much as you think, like, having Julia and Sean would be this huge thing. It just, to make something, I mean, a lot of, you know, a lot of those shows I like and a lot of shows that do well now are pretty much nostalgia porn. And we didn't have that going for us. You know, we aren't going to show a lot of, you know, because everybody's nostalgic for the 90s now. So you got a 90s show to pitch, you know, with, you know, Spin Doctors playing, you're gold, you know? Yeah. But I mean, 70s and Watergate, everybody was like, you know, I tell them, you know, I'm doing it in a new way. I'm doing it in this way that I actually think was closer to what it was. You know, it's very modern in the sense that it's not doing that mythology thing that I think all the baby boomer recountings of this period have done, where it kind of like the great man Nixon, the evil man Nixon, and the great Woodward and Bernstein, and the forces of evil versus the forces of good. I love JFK. I love Born on the 4th of July. I love, you know, Nixon was my favorite movie when I was a kid.
Yep.
But you know, there's a mundanity to all this that's very relatable that I think is being missed about this period. And it was, it's you know, also a good chance to talk about what's happening in this country now without, you know, doing a series about Trump, which I think, you know, a lot of people wouldn't be as open to. You know, my mom watches this and loves the show, and my mom's a huge Trump supporter. And you know, I got on the phone with her and she said she loved the show. And I said, you know, Mom, it's a lot about
it's happening now. Yeah.
Yeah. And she kind of was quiet and she goes, was just quiet on the other end of the line. And she goes, how did I know you were going to say that? You know, so she wouldn't be able to take me talking directly about Trump and the people. I wouldn't talk about Trump. I'd talk about the people around Trump, like Jeff Clark. Like, you know, he's surrounded by very related. I relate a lot to Rudy Giuliani. Mm-hmm. I mean, just this guy who's chasing what he was and can never get there. I mean, but people aren't ready. I don't think people like my mom would watch that. Like the advantage of there being no nostalgia, not a lot of nostalgia around Watergate, and it having been done so many times, it's kind of settled.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Kind of, there are a very few number of people on the internet who are like, oh dude, yeah, Nixon's the big bad guy, I guess, you know, like oh yeah, no, he wasn't that bad, you know. And it's like, yeah, buddy, you're the what's the last Japanese soldier on the island
who
World War II is over. That's kind of what those guys are.
Okay, back with more Robbie Pickering right after these words.
Bob Seska plays more music.
When I saw Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony a couple of weeks ago, the first thing I thought of was sort of an amalgam of Martha Mitchell and John Dean. You know, the John Dean aspect of it is that Cassidy Hutchinson was just as complicit as anyone inside the Trump White House. She was right there for so many of the worst things, including, you know, the botched response to COVID and all the rest of it. And then she finally steps up and is testifying and kind of deified as a hero as a consequence of that. And then also telling the truth and then being pilloried by the right-wing entertainment complex, you know, her veracity being questioned, being accused of lying and making up stories about Trump and the SUV and trying to commandeer and trying to get his ass down to the Capitol Hill. You know, it's just like there were so many things that it was like a direct overlap. Well, maybe not a necessarily, you know, one-to-one comparison, but there was a lot of Venn diagram overlap between what we saw, I think, with some of the witnesses testifying in the 1-6 committee and some of the characters that we saw who decided to tell the truth during Watergate, right?
Yeah, I think that Cassidy Hutchinson is a really admirable person. I think that the fact that she's so young and that she's probably dooming her career, at least in the Republican Party, you know, she's not a politician, but working in the party, I think it's really admirable. Mm-hmm. And I think actually, you know, people are one of the worst lines I hear constantly is like, oh, compared to what Nixon did, you know, Nixon is child's play compared to Trump and blah, 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 compared to Watergate. And it's like, yeah, Watergate wasn't the worst thing Nixon did. You know, Nixon stopped the peace talks in 1968 so he could win election and kept the war going on for another 4 or 5 years, which, you know, led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Mm-hmm. And you know, he secretly bombed Cambodia. I think we could chill on the I don't think we have to compare.
Yeah.
They're just as kind of fascist. I think that the thing that has changed is there's no sense of shame, and the Republican Party has inoculated themselves to shame at this point. They kind of have a entertainment complex that supports whatever narrative that they want to blindly follow. But I would say one of the things that's very encouraging about now is, you know, one of the other tales of that period were like, oh, Republicans back in Nixon's day. Oh, Barry Goldwater and George H.W. Bush and all these Republicans. Where are the Republicans that stand up to the evil in the Republican Party? Well, no, they stood up to Nixon once the tapes were discovered. And
right.
And it's his poll numbers went into the 20s. They weren't standing up for Nixon before that. And you know what? Liz Cheney is taking a stand, mm-hmm. even though her political career is over.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney is taking his, all you know, there are a few of these guys who are taking stands and they're losing a lot from it. And Trump is still immensely popular in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, and I'm no Liz Cheney fan, but I'm encouraged by some of that stuff. And Cassidy Hutchinson is not John Dean. She is much more honorable than John Dean was. You know, John yeah. Dean was one of the bad guys who became one, you know, who was central to the plot, who honorably decided to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dismiss John Dean's, the importance and the good of what John Dean did. And earlier I said something about Liddy looking down. I think Liddy, if I were Liddy looking at him, I'd be like, why is he such a hero? He did as much as I did. He just told the truth because mm-hmm. he knew they were going to throw him under the bus. I want to clear that up. But I think Cassidy Hutchins is a really admirable figure. I don't think Pat Cipollone is, really. I don't think a lot of the kind of quote adults in the room like Barr really are. But I think somebody like Cassidy Hutchinson is encouraging that that kind of person is still out there. And you know, she was a very compelling witness. And I got to say, as TV goes, I think these January 6 hearings have been pretty, you know, maybe not Watergate compelling, but they're pretty. Yeah. I got the Liddy word I was trying to think of.
Okay.
There's this quote from this article. It says, "Why should we listen?" I'm going to try to do his voice like you guys do it.
Okay.
"Why should we listen to these fulminating feminists, proselytizing poofters, the environmentally ill, these multilateralists?" Now I'm doing a Rush Limbaugh thing. "UN one world government worshippers and other politically correct castrati." Castrati.
Castrati. Oh my God. I have to add that to my list of Liddyisms right up there with, you know, he used to pronounce Alan Greenspan as Alan Greenspun. He used to insist that it wasn't Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Fed back in the day. He says, "No, it's Alan Greenspun."
Liddy is more nasally. "Why should we listen?"
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's up there. I mean, Shea nailed the lower voiced Liddy, and which Liddy would often do. Like for the first hour of a show, he would do nothing but read the newspaper for the first hour of the show. And that's when he was usually in that sort of Shea Whigham, more baritone range. But then when he would get to answering calls, he would start to climb up here into his nasal passages. And that was say things like,
"No." One of the other funny Liddy things in the show that I just want to talk about, not talk about, but there's this, one of the things I love about it is we really took great care into making his kids the very obedient, insanely yes. fucked up kids of a fascist. And there are like lots of little things in there mm-hmm. where it's just like they're little clues into like how mentally damaged his kids are becoming because of him, and how yes. also how obedient they are, and mm-hmm. how, you know, like, you know, like if you met them, you would be like, "These kids are so well behaved." And then you'd be driving home with your wife and be like, "Those kids were something else." That was, there's this line in the first episode where Liddy's upset and his kid says, "What's wrong, Daddy?" And he says, "You know, when you got caught eating all the other kids' glue in the classroom and all the other kids laughed at you, all the other kids laughed at Daddy today." And me and my friend, who's my co-EP, Amelia, who is a great writer of Liddy dialogue, we always laugh when we think his kid got caught eating all the other kids' glue. Like, the kid's so fucked up, he just eats everybody else's glue. Like, he doesn't eat his own. And just, like, these very specific ways Liddy's kids must have been screwed up because of him.
I can't even imagine. One of them
cries every time the phone rings. one of them is afraid of the dark and monkeys.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And one of them is... And then one of them is the most diligent hall monitor at the school. I mean, it's just like, oh my God, all these kids are going to be Nazi commandants when they grow up.
I just thought of something too, Robbie. You were mentioning earlier about Lydia and his perception of women. And it just occurred to me that he used to talk about Mrs. Liddy, Frances Liddy. And when he would say why he married her is because of, well, no, because of her broad hips and mathematical knowledge.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Two reasons alone. That's why he married Frances Liddy.
His ideal in his novel, he talks about Teutonic women. And Frances was a Teutonic woman.
Oh, it's my God.
Like, I mean, how can you not want to hear everything that guy says? But like you were laughing at him, but that guy would kill you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was constantly concerned, especially after I really pissed him off. I was deeply concerned that he was going to murder me in the radio station bathroom or something like that.
Why did you piss him off?
Oh, yeah. There was this signed David Letterman 8x10.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
It was on the wall of the newsroom that Liddy could see out of his peripheral vision. And Buzz, the news anchor at WJFK, it was his photo. And he had it up framed on the wall. And I actually have the actual photo right here. And so Liddy came in during a commercial break one day and said, "That grinning idiot is distracting. Take it down right now." Yeah, and of course, Gordon Liddy, because I'm tall, Gordon Liddy would refer to me as High Pockets. That was his nickname for me, because I'm a tall guy, and therefore my pockets are really high.
Oh, I love him so much.
Creativity, yeah. And I said, Mr. Liddy, I'm sorry, that's Buzz's photo. You're going to have to ask him, or you're going to have to ask Don and Mike, which was the afternoon show that I was also partially interning for at the time. And so he made this noise that I kind of interpret as just, and then he turns around and walks back into the air studio and probably goes and bitches to John Pop or something like that. High Pockets won't take that photo down. And so I went and I told this other intern at the radio station, Rob, and I said, Rob, Liddy just wanted me to take down the Letterman photo. So Rob and I got the photo, took it out of the frame. This is a Letterman photo, David Letterman photo. And we Xerox copied different sizes of Letterman's head and cut them all out. So it was just the head, like Xerox copies of the head. And we taped them up all over the radio station. I mean, we taped up little tiny ones on the leaves of the ficus tree in the lobby. We had them hidden in the bathroom outside Liddy's office. They were everywhere. We just festooned the entire radio station with Xerox copied David Letterman heads. And then the piece de resistance of the entire prank against Gordon Liddy, for fuck's sake, was we made a big blow up about the size of a full piece of copy paper of Letterman's head. And then taped it to the inside of the elevator door so that after Gordon Liddy's show, he would leave the radio studio, go into the lobby, get into the elevator door would close, and right at his eye level, along comes this big Letterman face staring him the eye. And from that point forward, Robbie, the Don and Mike show, which is technically the show that I worked on, they had to get security guards. They had to get bulletproof glass installed at the radio station. Oh, my God. The threats from Gordon Liddy's listeners alone. There was one day where a guy showed up to murder us all. A guy showed up in the lobby of the radio station with a handgun bleeding from the head for some reason. And, he was there to get revenge against the people from the Don and Mike show because of the way we tortured Gordon Liddy after the whole Letterman fiasco. And I love that David Letterman is somehow thrust into the middle of this controversy. But that was how we pissed him off. And so for the entire rest of the summer, I was thinking at some point, Gordon Liddy is going to kill me with a pencil. He's going to come after me with a sharpened pencil, drive it into my larynx and thrust downward. Something like that. Or, because he couldn't carry firearms, he would carry around like a ninja style blade in a ankle holster.
Oh, my God. I love him.
And so I imagine he could brandish that thing very quickly and slit my throat, and I'd be dead by the time anyone found me, you know, like in the radio station bathroom or something like that. I always imagine it happening in the bathroom, like him cornering me there. Because it was always an awkward thing. If you're standing at the urinal and then suddenly the architect of the Watergate break-in shows up and stands at the urinal next to you.
Do you know the scene in the pilot where Gordon Liddy confronts Jeb Magruder?
Yes.
That was supposed to happen with Jeb Magruder peeing in the urinal.
And
Gordon Liddy, but we were running low on locations or something like that. We had to X out a location. And but it was supposed to happen while Jeb Magruder is peeing. Gordon Liddy comes up to him and starts talking to him. It was supposed to be exactly what you said.
I don't know if it's too much information, Robbie, but if Gordon Liddy showed up in the bathroom and I was getting ready to pee, if I was standing at the urinal getting ready to pee, I wouldn't be peeing. I would get that thing where your pee would crawl back up, where you just couldn't do it. I couldn't pee with Gordon Liddy in the bathroom.
You deal with the hurt. You deal yes. with it. It stings, but I got to get out of here.
I'll hold it for another 3 minutes until Liddy is out of the bathroom, and then I can finally go. Liddy has left the bathroom, finally.
On some level, he must have appreciated the Letterman thing, and it probably made him hate you more, but he must have appreciated that you were more devious than he was.
Well, the irony is that
you got to understand, I have a version of Liddy in my head, which is probably nothing. I mean, it's probably a little like the real Liddy, but I'm talking about the Liddy I know, the Shea Whigham's Liddy. Who knows what he was like at this. I mean, maybe it was humorless.
Well, yeah. And also bear in mind that the Liddy I knew at that point, this is 1993 when I was working at WJFK in the same
room. Wow, right in so, the Clinton
years. Yeah, yeah. So by that point,
that is exactly where I was being driven to school every day in my stepdad's mid-sized 1985 Nissan truck and having to listen to G. Gordon Liddy every morning.
I can't God imagine. I'm gonna open today's show as we're talking with the Miami Vice theme, just in honor of which he would come back from every commercial break with that goddamn Miami Vice theme.
Oh my God.
Three times an hour. Got to hear that one three so times an hour.
All right, Bob.
So what's next? I got to ask you, what's next for you, not only just in your career generally, but obviously I have to ask if there's going to be a season two.
Yeah, we're working on it. Me and my creative partner and really, I can't say enough how great a writer she is. Amelia Gray, who wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
She wrote the seventh episode, the one with the rat. She wrote episodes 2-3 with me.
Incredible.
And we are working on a season 2 right now, which is a different story, a different interesting story, which I can't really divulge right now.
So it's going to be more like an anthology series where you're going to take another.
Yeah, an anthology series. Like, you know, I would describe it like this. If we do it, you know, it's still up in the air, but... Mm. You know, I am not interested in, weird stories from history. I'm more interested in the hot messes of history. People like Martha, people like Liddy, people who are kind of, you know, showing how human these stories can be and how messy and funny and embarrassing. And that, you know, history doesn't repeat itself. You know, people always say that as if history is the thing that does the repeating. It's people repeat themselves because we're all pretty much the same. I mean, I think Trump is a sociopath and that's a different thing. But like most people are just trying to get by in the best way they know how. And they aren't aware of their impact on other people and on history. They aren't aware when they're in the middle of these huge things. And it's just interesting to look. There are a lot of stories I want to do where you look at kind of these people who are hot messes and how that and how these kind of people ricocheting off other people like really guides history. And so we have a couple stories like that. And then we have, so we're working on season two, and then we have other stuff elsewhere, but you know, I'll be back. Gaslit has been, and your listeners, if they want to watch Gaslit, of course they can watch it on the Stars app.
Yep.
Also on, it's on Apple TV, Amazon Plus, and Hulu on the Stars channel. And then there's the actual Stars. You know, if you have DirecTV or anything like that, you can watch it there. But, fantastic. You know, we want to do more stuff. I want to do more stuff in this vein. And then otherwise I'm just raising my kids. Oh, by the way, my son Roscoe is the baby Julia Holt at the end.
Oh, okay, great. So
he was like 3 weeks old when we needed a baby.
And that's wonderful. Oh my God.
So I have a little girl and a little boy, and I'm raising them and trying to do this crazy life while I raise them, yeah. You know?
I love the name Roscoe. That's perfect. And also, yeah. You guys going to qualify for the Emmys next year, I assume?
No, we qualified this year, but we got four Emmy nominations, but Julia and Sean got snubbed.
Oh, man.
And the show, limited series, they could only nominate five shows, so a lot of shows got snubbed for that. But the thing I really just have a problem with is that Julia wasn't nominated. I mean, yeah. Shay should have been nominated too. But, you know, I think being on Stars, there's a lesser subscription base than a lot of these other platforms. And we came out kind of at this tumult of all these other shows coming out. So, we got four Emmy nominations, but we should have gotten more.
Yeah. Oh my God. Absolutely. And I just have to congratulate you because it is a hell of a piece of work. It is like, as far as I'm concerned, you know, when you're talking about historical drama, just in a general sense, this is really like the gold standard in terms of how to approach subject matter like this. And so, thank you for producing this show and working your ass off to get it made in the first place. And then shepherding it through, an incredible production where every layer of it was just spot on, just absolutely.
Yeah, I'm incredibly proud of it. I'm not somebody who I'm very hard on my own work, but in my opinion, I think it's my favorite thing. I could talk about it all day. I think that it's, to me, it's the best thing on TV, and I think people should watch it.
Themselves.
It definitely has balls that I will.
That's for sure. It's one of the best of the year so far. Thank you so much for your time, Robbie, today. This is a blast. I think we could end up talking about Gordon Liddy for hours and hours and hours. God. So thank you for indulging me.
Thank you for indulging me. It's nice to have somebody to talk Liddy about.
All right. Well, good luck getting season two made. I'll be rooting for it. And maybe my girlfriend would get her dream, too, of having a Shea Whigham Liddy series.
Oh man, that's the biggest compliment when somebody tells me their loved one or their you know, somebody in their lives likes the show and is invested in. So tell her thank you very much.
And I will. And
Shea Whigham also thanks.
Okay, sounds great. Hey, thanks again, Robbie. Really appreciate it. We'll talk to you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye bye.